Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Thursday, September 17th. I'm your reader, Mary Dove. Our first article from the Courier today is The Gallagher Blue Dorn Pivots to Stay Engaged in Face of COVID-19 by journalist Melody Parker. We open with a picture of the Gallagher Blue Dorn. The University of Northern Iowa's wind ensemble students rehearse with protective barriers on the Great Hall stage at the Gallagher Blue Dorn Performing Arts Center. And the article begins, many performing arts centers in Iowa have been temporarily shuttered during the COVID-19 pandemic, including Hancher Auditorium at the University of Iowa. Officials at Iowa State University in Ames recently announced it was closing C.Y. Stevens Auditorium indefinitely as it determines the center's future viability. Live concerts, Broadway shows, and other performances in the Great Hall at the Gallagher Blue Dorn Performing Arts Center are in limbo for the interim. That doesn't mean the center has been sitting idle or shut its doors. Pivot. That's what's been done since COVID-19 hit, said Steve Cardigan, CBPAC Executive Director and Associate Dean of Outreach and Special Programs at the University of Northern Iowa. Most art centers and schools of music threw up their hands, but we realized early on that we needed to pivot to stay engaged with the community. That meant being creative and coming up with ways to connect. We've done some stuff we've never done before. We don't want people to get used to not having opportunities for live music, live theater, and live performances, he said. The center also is home to the Waterloo Cedar Falls Symphony Orchestra and a resource for UNI students of music theater. Recently, the center launched a local legends concert series from the Great Hall, featuring live-streamed, professionally produced shows by area bands and performers. This summer, the center staff collaborated with Cedar Falls Community Main Street, Hearst Center for the Arts, and others to present Movies Under the Moon series as a drive-in at a campus parking lot. That proved to be so popular that the Gallagher Blue Dorn offered ticketed date night movies and an outdoor drive-in rock concert. We brought a portable stage from 1959, no kidding, and because we have the people to do it, worked on it, so now it's like new. I'm seeing us using that in the future for street and block parties. That could be a blast, Cardigan said. At 4 p.m. September 26th, yesterday and today, an interactive concert featuring the music of the Beatles will be the second drive-in concert. Now, with the students back on campus, the center has found ways to allow student ensembles and choruses to rehearse together in safe environments while taking COVID-19 risk mitigation steps. It's really cool to see students rehearsing in the Great Hall and lobby. It's neat to see the spaces being used so effectively. It achieves some level of normalcy for students whose studies require performance, whether it's an instrument or voice, Cardigan explained. The center and UNI Music have been on the leading edge, he said, in taking appropriate and thoughtful steps to allow students to practice, borrowing from West Point Military Academy's guidebook for large ensembles. The Academy's approach was developed and tested during the school's summer band session, to reduce the risk of viral spread while maintaining practical needs of ensemble performance, according to the guide. That includes providing a large space for rehearsals to allow for maximum air dispersion, expanding distance between musicians, and using plexiglass shielding between players. At UNI, the Great Hall's sizable stage has become the setting for large ensemble rehearsals. In addition to appropriate distancing, players sit inside shields of boxes made from plastic vinyl that can easily be sanitized. String players and percussionists perform masked, and some of the woodwind and brass players have masks with special holes cut in them just big enough for their instrument's mouthpiece, Cardigan explained. In pre-COVID days, Large ensembles had two rehearsals in the Great Hall in preparation for one or two performances per semester, while wind and orchestra met two or three times weekly in the center's 300-seat Davis Hall and choral gathered in the 125-seat Jeb Hall. Now all of their 2 to 3 week per week rehearsals for each wind orchestra ensemble are in the Great Hall, and all choral rehearsals are in the McElroy Lobby. The Great Hall also has become the rehearsal space for Jazz Band 1, which normally rehearses and performs in Russell Hall, said Blake Alex Singer, the Gallagher Blue Dorn marketing manager. Jazz Bands 2 and 3 have also moved over to the Gallagher Blue Dorn and are rehearsing in Davis Hall. We haven't had any of the jazz ensembles in our building since the Russell renovation was completed in 2008, Argo Singer pointed out. The hall is sanitized between ensembles, and the air handler unit that scrubs the air is tested frequently for quality assurance. In addition, the Waterloo Cedar Falls Symphony Orchestra will open its season at 7 p.m. October 3rd with a live streamed concert from the Great Hall stage. Movements of Van Tobin's Septet for Winds and Strings, Opt 20, will be performed in celebration of the composer's 250th birthday. We've pivoted pretty hard, and it's turned out to be a good answer for us. We've done some things we always talked about doing but couldn't find the time. I can see a festival in the future coming out of the Local Legends series and continuing to build relationships in the community. We've found the value in this whole experience, Cardigan added. More local news? Cedar Falls hotel rates and occupancy down amid the pandemic, but derecho saw a spike. A spike in hotel occupancy numbers and daily rates in August, courtesy of a destructive derecho that forced many to find shelter in the Cedar Valley, was one of the bright spots amid an otherwise dismal year so far for the hotel and motel operators in Cedar Falls. The number of people staying in hotels, as well as the average daily rate for rooms, were both down in Cedar Falls overall from June through September, according to information presented by Cedar Falls Tourism and Cultural Manager Kim Manning. The hotels are struggling a little bit, Manning said, noting their numbers were significantly lower on daily occupancy and daily rate charged. A spreadsheet she shared during the Visits and Tourism Bureau meeting Wednesday showed the numbers from June 27th through September 12th in detail. In 2019, summer occupancy in Cedar Falls hotels was between 55 and 80%. This year's coronavirus pandemic brought that down to between 30 to 50%, most sharply during the July 4th period. But in early August, when the derecho brought widespread damage to homes and shut off power for weeks across a wide swath of Iowa's midsection, hotel occupancy and daily rates surged even higher than in 2019. Occupancy rates were between 70 and 90% between August 15th and August 29th, while weekly average daily rates, or ADR, were at or above 2019 levels. You can see a spike in August, Manning told the group. Unfortunately, that's due to us housing our neighbors from Cedar Rapids that came here to take shelter after the derecho. The numbers had since returned to level below 2019, and a recent survey on the region's tourism site showed people were still not quite ready to travel amid the continuing pandemic. Manning said the survey showed 14% of people were extremely comfortable traveling in August, while 39% were just comfortable traveling. That's up slightly from the same survey in May, showing 13% extremely comfortable and 33% comfortable. You can see it's kind of starting to inch up a little bit, although it's still extremely low, she said. Testimony begins in shooting trial. Waterloo. Waterloo. Police told jurors they found two pistols when they were investigating a shot fired at a man in the hallway of a Waterloo department in April. They also found a box of ammunition compatible with one of the guns. It appears to be the same Remington Ultimate Defense ammo, Officer Charles Nichols told jurors Wednesday as testimony began in the trial of Jake DeMott Williams. The first trial in the Black Hawk County since the beginning of the coronavirus pandemic. Williams is charged with the intimidation with a weapon, carrying weapons, and other charges. Prosecutors said Williams had an argument with his sister's boyfriend, Kevante Reed, on April 15th, and then came to Reed's apartment building in Miriam Drive around 11:15 p.m., fired a single shot up at a common stairwell. The bullet missed Reed. Nichols said the round struck a wooden door in a hallway utility room and then entered an electrical panel where it came to rest. The trajectory of the projectile shown in the series of holes was consistent with the shot being fired from the bottom of the stairs, he said. Shortly after the shooting, other officers stopped Williams in an area near Randolph Street apartment building. Police found a box of .45 caliber ammunition and a 9mm Smith & Wesson handgun in the car. Authorities then searched Williams' apartment and found a .45 caliber Smith & Wesson pistol with an extended magazine stuffed between couch cushions. Under cross-examination by the defense, Nichols said he wasn't able to tell the caliber of the copper-jacked bullet found in the electrical panel because the round was too disfigured and fragmented. The defense also noted that an assortment of ammunition was found in the .45 caliber pistol. Testimony in the case continues today, Thursday. Test Iowa looking to winterize coronavirus testing sites. By Charlie Nurbergall, Associated Press, Des Moines. With the imminent onset of cold weather and flu season in Iowa, Governor Kim Reynolds said Wednesday state officials are in the process of winterizing Test Iowa sites. Currently, Test Iowa drive-through sites are available in Cedar Rapids, Council Bluffs, Davenport, Des Moines, Marshalltown, Storm Lake, Waterloo, and West Des Moines. Also, the governor said, state officials have partnered with health care providers for coronavirus testing, clinics in 15 counties, Black Hawk, Carroll, Cass, Crawford, Des Moines, Dickinson, Dubuque, Kossuth, Mitchell, Page, Plymouth, Potawatomi, Story, Union, and Wright. Another 19 test sites are set up at community colleges, private colleges, and state universities. The 3,000 Test Iowa samples are among the 5,000 processed daily at the State Hygienic Lab. Michael Pintella, director of the State Hygienic Lab, said his facility at the University of Iowa Research Park in Coralville is upgrading its equipment to handle 6,000 tests a day by October. We're fast approaching about 500,000 tests combined in the two labs that have been processing COVID-19 tests and antibody results since March, Patella said during Reynolds' news conference. This pandemic is unprecedented and very demanding of laboratory resources. We've been facing many challenges after moving from a facility mostly testing well water and newborn disease screenings to the COVID-19 pandemic. The challenges are likely to escalate in the coming months as Iowa combines testing for seasonal influenza and COVID-19 infections, Patella said. We are committed to meeting the needs of the state. We'll do all that we can to perform the testing necessary to control this pandemic and protect the health and lives of Iowans. Reynolds said State Department of Transportation and Iowa National Guard officials are working with county emergency managers to identify alternate locations near current Test Iowa sites that can be winterproofed to test a large number of people quickly and effectively in much the same way the drive-through locations now do. We're looking for sites that will allow us to continue drive-through sites for throughout the winter, the governor said. The goal is to have new sites secured in the next few weeks so that we can stay ahead of the weather as much as possible. Reynolds also put out a plea for healthcare providers to partner with the state to increase access to testing in rural areas and smaller towns as part of a long-term testing strategy. According to the Iowa Department of Public Health website Wednesday afternoon, nearly 714,000 Iowans have been tested since the outbreak of the coronavirus. Of those tests, 75,260 were positive for the virus, for a positivity rate of 10.7%. To date, 1,235 Iowans have died of COVID-19. As of Wednesday morning, Iowa had 775 new confirmed coronavirus cases in the last 24 hours and one additional death. Other local news for the Waterloo-Cedar Falls area. Trump to bolster ethanol becomes campaign flashpoint. James Lynch, Gazette, Des Moines Bureau. And it opens with the ethanol train cars wait outside the Southwest Iowa Renewable Energy Plant as ethanol producer in Council Bluffs with a couple tanker cars. Cedar Rapids. President Donald Trump has been receiving praise from farm state Republicans for his decision to deny the gap year waivers and increase access to E15 corn-based ethanol, but it also was panned by Democrats Wednesday as nothing more than a political ploy. What the administration has done is really an insult, said Michigan U.S. Senator Debbie Stabenow, ranking Democrat on the Ag Committee. It would be welcome news if it was at the beginning of a Trump presidency, but already the damage has been done. So our farmers are hurting, and they need more than just some lip service right before the election, Stabenow said Wednesday on a call organized by Biden for president. Trump has failed to deliver on the promises he made to Midwestern farmers 4 years ago. Better trade deals, investments in rural infrastructure, and support for the renewable fuel industry, added former Iowa Governor Tom Vilsack. The reality, 3.5 years later, as we approach the election, is that President Trump has failed to keep any of these promises, said Vilsack, who served as President Barack Obama's U.S. Department of Agriculture Secretary for 8 years and now leads the U.S. Dairy Export Council. Now at this late date, he becomes a Johnny-come-lately to the third promise of supporting renewable fuel. Trump and the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency denied waivers petroleum refineries had sought retroactively, some as far back as 2011. That would have allowed the petroleum industry to remove hundreds of millions of gallons of corn-based ethanol from the market and sidestep a congressional requirement for blending at least 15 million gallons of ethanol a year into nation's fuel supply. The president's action is a big deal, according to Iowa's two Republican U.S. senators who had lobbied the president to deny the waivers and remove outdated restrictions on the year-round sale of E15. I applaud President Trump for keeping his word and supporting our farmers and biofuel producers, Senator Tuck Grassley said. This is an important step that will allow more gas stations to provide E15 to Iowans year-round without significantly changing their infrastructure. Senator Joni Ernst said the Trump administration listened to the call for action from her, Grassley, and other supporters for the RFS. The president's move will provide some certainty to biofuel producers who have for far too long been yanked around by the EPA, Ernst said. Ernst on Wednesday received the Fueling Growth Award for the sixth consecutive year from Growth Energy, a trade association, for her support for biofuels. Her Democratic challenger, Teresa Greenfield, said the president's decision does nothing to erase the damage Senator Ernst did by voting for a fossil fuel lobbyist to run the EPA. Unlike Ernst, I'll always put our farmers first, not big oil donors. Other local news. Ernst votes on judges, health care criticized. Nice picture of Senator Joni Ernst. Our Iowan speaks during a news conference with Senate Republicans on Wednesday on Capitol Hill in Washington. Progressive groups are attacking Senator Joni Ernst, accusing her of repeatedly lying about her support for health care, especially protecting people with pre-existing conditions. Ben Jellos, president of People for the American Way, contrasted Ernst's stated position of support for protecting health care to her votes for President Donald Trump's judicial nominees who have and will continue to rule on cases aiming to undermine the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare. She has repeatedly rubber-stamped judges put up by Donald Trump who are there for the express purpose of destroying the ACA, he said on a call Wednesday. She has repeatedly voted for these judges knowing full well that they will do, frankly, as they have promised to do, which is to destroy access to health care for millions of people in our country. As recently as Monday, Ernst voiced her support for ensuring that everyone has access to health care and health insurance. During a candidate forum with the Greater Des Moines Partnership, a community and economic development group, Ernst said the federal government has a role. She favors a federal backstop for those who need additional assistance with health insurance. First and foremost, again, pre-existing conditions, they need to be covered, Ernst said, adding that she has family members with pre-existing conditions. I would never, ever want to see my family members or yours denied the opportunity to be covered in a fair and reasonable way by health insurance companies, Ernst said. In addition, she said Congress should be looking at ways we can provide that federal government's backstop so that people don't face that financial strain when they are dealing with those difficult issues in healthcare. But Matt Savanik, executive director of Progress Iowa, said it's important that voters understand the connection between Ernst's vote on judicial nominees and healthcare. Who the president puts up for judicial nominations from lower courts all the way to the Supreme Court is on the ballot this fall, he said. Also on the call was Susan Blocker, who, with her husband, owns Michka Press in Cedar Rapids. After seeing their health insurance costs increase and eventually become unavailable, they now save money by buying coverage on the ACA exchange. Also, State Representative Timi Brown Powers, D. Waterloo, spoke about the needs of more than 70,000 Iowans who have contracted COVID-19 and who now have a pre-existing condition. A core message of U.S. Senate Democrat challenger Teresa Greenfield has been that Republican incumbent Senator Joni Ernst can't be trusted. Joni Ernst was caught knowingly accepting illegal contributions from corporations and had to pay the largest penalty ever for an Iowa politician, according to a Greenfield campaign ad. Ernst's campaign was even caught red-handed taking illegal contributions from corporations. However, in a September 15th letter, the Federal Election Commission has flagged Greenfield's campaign, saying its fundraising report discloses one or more contributions that appear to exceed the limits of $2,800 per person to a campaign. Her campaign has 30 days to reply to the FEC, but the Ernst campaign isn't waiting for a ruling. In the words of Teresa Greenfield, Ms. Greenfield has been hypocritical, caught red-handed taking illegal contributions, said Ernst campaign spokesman Melissa Decht. The situation is part of a pattern for Greenfield, Dutch said. Coupled with her campaign getting caught with election fraud for submitting false signatures in exchange for ballot access, it's clear Teresa Greenfield can't be trusted. In 2018, when Greenfield ran for a U.S. House seat, her campaign manager was charged with felony election fraud. The FEC letter asked Greenfield's campaign to further explain 18 donations totaling $81,000, a $30,600 discrepancy. The Greenfield campaign downplayed the letter, saying it was not the same as Ernst's violation in 2017 when the FEC penalized Joni from Iowa for receiving $37,190 in excessive contribution. The Ernst campaign fired the fundraising firm involved, and paid a $14,500 fine because the funds were not returned within the permissible time frame. Notices like these, asking to review how contributions are attributed, are routine, Greenfield spokesman Sam Newton said. It is Senator Ernst who was forced to pay the largest FEC fine in history for an Iowa politician after knowingly and illegally accepting prohibited contributions from corporations. She also still refuses to explain reports she illegally coordinated with a dark money group set up by her own top aides. You are listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Thursday, September 17th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Hera La Harris, Laverne Harris, 1956 to 2020. Laverne Harris, 64, of Waterloo, died Sunday, September 13th at Cox Medical Center in Branson, Missouri. He was born January 21, 1956, in Waterloo, son of Cleveland and Emerald Cole Harris. He married Linda Maxine Culpepper, September 3, 1977, in Waterloo. Laverne graduated from Waterloo East High School. He was employed as a pastor, educator at Upper Room Tabernacle, and has been an ambassador for Christ Church Global since 1987. An elder since 2008. He was a driver's education instructor for Drive Tech with the Waterloo Community Schools. Laverne never met a stranger. He was kind and friendly. He lived to serve the Lord, and the good Lord has called him home. He was a blessing and will be greatly missed. He is survived by his wife, Linda, a son, Xavier L. Harris of Waterloo, three daughters, Shannon C. Harris of Houston, Texas, Iris S. Harris of Ames, Jessica N. Harris of Waterloo, six grandchildren, Jontavius, Kali, Kalafi, Alama, and Micah, three sisters, Jessica Fillmore, Carolyn, Carl Samuels, both of Waterloo, Darlene Curtis, Austin, of Coffeyville, Kansas. Preceded in death by his parents, two sisters, Lily Harris and Florine Dixon, and a brother, Leon Harris. Services will be 11th, Saturday, September 19th, at Union Missionary Baptist Church, with burial in Fairview Cemetery. Visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. Friday, September 18th, at Hagerty Wyckoff Garup Funeral Service on South Street, and at the church 1 hour before services on Saturday. Those attending are required to wear a mask. Memorials may be directed to the family. Condolences may be left at www.hagertywyckoffgaruff.com. Kelvin Berger, 66, of Traer, passed away at home on Tuesday, September 15, 2020. A private family service will be held for Kelvin. A celebration of life will be held at a later date. In lieu of flowers, please direct memorials to the family. Online condolences may be left at www.overtonfuneralhomes.com. Lloyd Clayton Hashkins, 97, of Owine and formerly of the Jessup area, died Sunday, September 13th at Grandview Healthcare Center in Owine, where he lived the past 7 years. Gravesite services and burial will be 11 a.m. Saturday, September 19th at Grandview Cemetery, Austin, Minnesota. Visitation will be from 5 to 7 p.m. Friday, September 18th, 2020, at the White Funeral Home, Jessup, Iowa. Due to the COVID-19 pandemic, mask and social distancing will be expected. Memorials will be directed to the family. Online condolences may be posted at www.white-mounthope.com. White Funeral Home, Jessup, Iowa is in charge of arrangements. Irving Sadler, 1944 to 2020. Irving Peter Sadler, 76, of Dunkerton, Iowa, died Sunday, September 13, 2020, at Ravenwood Specialty Care in Waterloo. Private family services will be held Friday at St. Francis Catholic Church, Barclay, rural Dunkerton, Iowa. Burial will be in the church cemetery with military rites. Memorials may be directed to the family in care of Russell Sadler, 3723 Rice Road, Dunkerton, Iowa, 50626. Online condolences may be posted at www.white-mounthope.com. Irving was born January 28, 1944, in Blackhawk County, Iowa, the son of Leonard Sadler and May Federkane Sadler. He graduated from Dunkerton High School and then served in the United States Army during Vietnam. He was a farmer and farmed with his family near Dunkerton. He was a member of St. Francis Catholic Church, Barclay. Irving is survived by four brothers, Harold Sadler of Dunkerton, Ed and Donna Sadler of Fairbank, Melvin and Teresa Sadler of Dunkerton, Gerald and Elaine Sadler of Waterloo. Three sisters, Rita Schmitz of Jessup, Judy Starbeck of Waterloo, Donna Nelson of Madrid, and a sister-in-law, Tress Sadler of Fairbank, and nieces and nephews. His parents, one sister, Mary in infancy, four brothers, Elvin in infancy, Dean Sadler, Raymond Sadler, Garald Sadler, and a niece, Lisa Dolan DeRoss, preceded him in death. Jeanette Stehmeyer, 1967 to 2020. Jeanette Rose Stehmeyer, 53, of St. Lucas, passed away Friday, September 11, 2020, at the Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, Iowa City, Iowa. Jeanette, the daughter of Arthur and Madonna Lukes Samick, was born on May 17, 1967, in Waterloo, Iowa. She graduated from Jessup High School in 1985. Jeanette was united in marriage with Brian Stehmeyer on October 28, 1989. To this union, they were blessed with two children, April and Matthew. Jeanette was a caregiver at Full Circle for disabled people. She enjoyed doing craft work, singing, playing cards, making collages. Most of all, she loved being a mother. She loved watching her children grow. Jeanette is survived by her husband of 30 years, Brian Stehmeyer of West Union, her children, April and Matthew Stehmeyer, her parents, Arthur and Madonna Samick, her brother, Steve and Vicki Samick, in-laws, Steve and Gail Stehmeyer, Mike and Sue Stehmeyer, Charles Stehmeyer, Marge Burt Oster, Diane and Jeff Mullicky, Donna and John Callen, Angie and Sam Smith, Arlene and Ed Mullican, Joyce and Marty McLean, Kurt Stehmeyer, Kay and Tom Gardner, James Patty Stehmeyer, and many nieces, nephews, and great-nieces and nephews. Jeanette was preceded in death by her sister Linda, father and mother-in-law, Donald and Margaret Stehmeyer, and her grandparents. Mass of Christian burial will be at 11 a.m. on Friday, September 18, 2020, at St. Luke Catholic Church in St. Lucas, Iowa, with Reverend Nick Radlaw as the celebrant. There will also be a two-hour visitation before Mass at church on Friday with the rosary at 9 a.m. Burial will follow at St. Luke Catholic Cemetery in St. Lucas, Iowa. Burnham Wood and Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Service, West Union, Iowa, is helping the family with arrangements. Here is a death notice of Lloyd C. Haskins, who we already shared. Looks like we can maybe do one more with Randy Anderson, 1956 to 2020. Randy Marvin Anderson, age 63, of Waterloo, died September 13, 2020, after a long battle with dementia. He was born on November 19, 1956, in Waterloo, the son of Marvin and Joyce Neville Anderson. He graduated from Southeast Polk High School in 1956. On August 1, 1981, he married Rosie Wirtz at the Little Brown Church in Nashua. Randy worked as a plumber and a pipe fitter with Viking Pump for 33 years, retiring in 2012. Randy is survived by his wife, Rosie Anderson of Cedar Falls, daughters Jen and Tim Wolf of Hudson, Melissa and Brian Sinwell of Nashua, grandchildren Natalie Sinwell, Kaylin Wolf, Lucas Sinwell, Mila Wolf, mother Joyce Anderson of Altoona, siblings Ronnie Anderson of Altoona, Rusty Anderson of Olathe, Kansas, Rhonda Anderson of Altoona. He is preceded in death by his father, Marvin Anderson, and brother Rick Anderson. Visitation will be held at Prairie Lakes Church in Cedar Falls, September 19th, from 2 to 3 p.m., with a celebration of life service following. All are welcome to attend the celebration of Randy's life. Online guest book may be left at www.richardsonfuneralservice.com. We'll turn our attention to some sport news. Prep football, AP, and Dyke New Hartford look to mound momentum. Parkersburg. Momentum has been a fickle beast for both the Appleton Parkersburg and Dyke New Hartford football teams. The Wolverines seemingly had it following an impressive win in Class 3A Oskaloosa to open the season, but may have been shut out in each of their last two games, losses to Grundy Center and South Hamilton. The Falcons took their share of lumps in back-to-back losses to Clear Lake and West Marshall before finally finding their footing last Friday in a win over Hudson. As the two teams prepare to face each other Friday in Parkersburg at Ed Thomas Field at the midway point of the 2020 season, head coach Don Betts and Alex Pollock both feel their rivalry game will be the push that could ignite their teams. As crazy as it seems, you are looking for that one big push that is going to get that momentum going into the playoffs, because it's going to be here before you know it, and this is the game. They are probably thinking the exact same thing, said Pollock. I think we both can look at our 1-2 record and say this isn't where we want to be, but looking ahead, there's a lot of possibility. Beth says AP, like his Dyke New Hartford squad, probably feel closer to summit of the mountain rather than at the top bottom looking up. We need to keep getting better, Beth said. I've told our team the last 2 weeks we are not that far away. We had a pretty brutal stretch to start the season, honestly. We faced two really good ball clubs the last two football games. We have some little things we need to get better at. I think our kids' heads are in the right place and they are working hard. We had a great practice last night, and that is what we really have to focus on, is continuing to get better. Both teams had similar struggles with turnovers. The Wolverines trailed just 8-0 with 4 minutes to go last week against South Hamilton and turned the ball over and ended up losing by 3 touchdowns. Really thought our offense, given the conditions last week, did a lot of good things. We got playmakers. There are a lot of things to build upon from last week, both offensively and defensively, said Betts. The Falcons have lost 7 fumbles in 3 games. We have a lot of good things, Pollock said. The biggest issue we've had is turnovers, and turnovers at critical times. Friday against Hudson, we fumbled the ball multiple times inside the 20, going in to score, so ball security is going to be a big thing for us. Both teams have strong run games. Drew Larson for Dyke New Hartford and Chase Verrett for AP both have good quarterbacks, Nathan Moore for the Wolverines and Owen Thomas for the Falcons. Offensively, for so many years, they were in that hurry-up wing T offense, especially when Ed Thomas was there, Beth said. They were so darn good at that. Then they tried a few things that last year, and now they are back to the I formation. Don't do a hurry up. But it is that same philosophy to run the football, come off the ball, knock you off the ball mentally, they had for almost 30 years, I really think they have swung back to that mindset. For Pollock, he sees a young Wolverine team that with time will figure it out. They are a big physical team led by a Hall of Fame coach. Anytime you have that, I think you are dangerous, said Pollock. They have always had the athletic athletes. I just don't think they have totally put it all together. What other sports news do we have today? Charles City Task Force proposes start new athletic conference. They have a picture of a fan that holds a sign in support of Charles City baseball player Jeremiah Chapman. The Charles City School District made it clear back in mid-July that it was considering taking drastic action after then junior Jeremiah Chapman was the subject of racist taunts during a baseball game at Waverly Shell Rock. On Monday night, it became clear just how far the district might be willing to go. At a Charles City School Board meeting, a district task force recommended that the school leave the NEIC and start its own athletic conference. The task force, made up of coaches, students, parents, alumni, and district leadership, made the recommendation after evaluating Charles City's relationship to the conference. The district said in July that if the task force found that the school was in unhealthy partnerships with the NEIC, the school would look to join a new conference. According to Charles City Superintendent Mike Fisher, the final recommendation was based on several different factors, and not just the incident that happened to Chapman. It wasn't just about the summer, Fisher said. It was about historical context. We looked at history with the conference, other previous events, good and bad. We also looked at the sustainability of the conference. With Owine leaving, it becomes very tenuous for the conference to stay in business. We're down to the minimum amount of schools with six. If we lose any more, the conference could fall apart anyway. Investigating all these different possibilities and outcomes, it became clear that the wise and healthy decision was to pursue new partnerships. Fisher said that 10 area schools are currently interested in joining the proposed new conference, but declined to give specifics, since the idea is still a non-binding proposal. Fisher expects the school board to take action on the proposal sometime in the fall. At that point, if the board approves the idea, the school would send out invitations to the interested schools. In all, the process for starting a brand new conference could take up to 2 years. Keisha Cunnings, the mother of Jeremiah Chapman, said that she is happy that the action is being taken, even after the story about her son faded from the news cycle. I'm really satisfied that our district is taking that situation very seriously, and they want to offer up some type of solution, Cunnings said. I know that it may seem like we are just running from the problem, but I don't feel like that is what we're doing. We're trying to come up with something because the neighboring district was not going to do anything. Chapman, who was a member of the task force, said he wanted to make sure that his younger siblings and other future Charles City athletes have a safe place to play. I'm not really worried from the one incident that happened to me, Chapman said, but I don't want my siblings to go through it. I know in my situation I reacted that way, but the others will act completely different. I don't want them to have to go through that, or my mom to have to stress about it anymore, or any other parent. After the Chapman incident went public, the Waverly Shell Rock School District posted a statement saying that the district had completed an investigation into the allegations, but would not be releasing specific findings since all individuals involved were students. In response, the Charles City District announced the new task force and the possibility of leaving the NEIC. Since 2008, Waverly Shell Rock has finished last in the NEIC sportsmanship standings every year. According to Fisher, the proposed new conference will be one based on character and shared values, which is welcome news to Chapman. The other teams that are willing to join this conference, they are all down for wanting to change as a community. That made me more comfortable because I want everyone to be comfortable where they are at, home or away. That is why I brought up my siblings. I don't want them playing somewhere and not feeling safe. All right, here's one for college. Hawkeye's happy, ready to go back to work, by Steve Batterson. We have a picture of a wide receiver, Brandon Smith, stretches for the goal line as he tackles a USC cornerback, Elijah Griffin, during the 2019 Holiday Bowl in San Diego, Iowa City. Walking into the Iowa Football Complex Wednesday, Hawkeye receiver Brandon Smith was caught on camera wearing a mask that struggled to shield a wide smile. "Happy to be back," the Iowa senior said, echoing the sentiments of players, coaches, administrators, parents, and fans after the Big Ten reversed course and announced plans to start its previously postponed football season on the weekend of October 23rd. Big Ten teams will play an 8-game regular season that will end with a unique 9-week twist. In addition to playing a conference championship game featuring the champions of the two divisions, the Big Ten will pair opponents who finished in each corresponding position in the two divisions all the way down to a matchup between 7th-place finishers on the final week of the season. The conference announced Wednesday morning it will move forward with the football season after the Big Ten Council of Presidents and Chancellors adopted significant medical protocols, including daily antigen testing, enhanced cardiac screening, an enhanced data-driven approach to facilitate decisions about whether practices and games can take place. The same group of campus leaders had decided on August 11th to postpone all fall sports in the league because of concerns about the COVID-19 pandemic and the ability to protect the health and safety of student-athletes. Morton Shapiro, president of Northwestern University and chair of the Big Ten Administrative Group, said medical advancements and additional research in the coronavirus and myocarditis ultimately led the conference to its decision. "When the decision was made 5 weeks ago, we were told there was virtually no chance to have a season safely, but medical opinions have changed," Serpino said. "When facts changed, minds changed." Big Ten president and chancellor studied those changes last week, hearing Saturday from the Big Ten's Return to Competition Task Force, Medical Committee, and gaining additional information Sunday before ultimately reaching the decision to move forward. Iowa Director of Athletics Gareb Barta said the frequency, availability, and reliability of daily testing was a game changer. Barta credited the work of medical professionals on every Big Ten campus for tireless work in creating strong protocols that can be consistently applied on every campus. "Daily testing for student-athletes, coaches, and staff members will begin on Big Ten campuses as soon as possible and will be in place by September 30th. Teams will take the field for their first game 3.5 weeks later." Iowa coach Kurt Ferentz called that welcome news for all players, coaches, and fans. Like their peers throughout the conference, the Hawkeyes have continued to train since fall semester. Classes began and will move into a more preseason camp mode in upcoming days. "We are raring to go, but we're hardly ready to go, and that's a big concern I have right now," Ferentz said in an interview with the Big Ten Network. "But just to get some clarity, and be able to tell our guys that there's a specific start date to the season is great." Ferentz said his players have maintained a good attitude and work ethic throughout several weeks of uncertainty. "The players are very excited to play, and the coaches are excited to coach them," Ferentz said. The Big Ten's decision comes days after teams in two other Power 5 conferences, the Atlantic Coast and the Big 12, started their seasons. A third, the Southeastern Conference, will kick off its season next week. That, added to outside pressure, Big Ten leaders felt from players, coaches, parents, and players of fans who had lobbied for the conference to revisit its August 11th decision. Although Shapiro said the changing medical opinions carry the bulk of the weight. Whether parents around the Big Ten played a role in this all really doesn't matter, as long as the conference reversed its decision and is giving the young men a chance to compete, said Jay Gallagherberger, the father of Iowa offensive lineman Mark Gallenberger of Bettendorf and one of a number of Hawkeye parents who rallied for the result they received Wednesday. He said the attention brought parents of players together from throughout the conference. I know it brought us closer as Iowa parents, and I suspect it did the same throughout the Big Ten. I'm just happy for the players that we have a season that they've been working toward. For us, that is what this has all been about. Wisconsin Director of Athletic Barry Alvarez, who chairs a return to competition task force scheduling committee, said his group presented four schedule models to the Big Ten Council, which selected the start date and the 8+1 plan. It will create a very unique Champions Week, Alvarez said, adding that putting together a 9-game season for all teams has benefited for student athletes. The feeling was that 9 games makes the season more meaningful. A number of players are trying to make decisions about whether to opt in or opt out with 9 games. It creates a more meaningful option. Alvarez said the schedule is still being finalized but should be released to the Big Ten within the next week. He said it'll include 4 home games and 4 road games for each team, with games played on Fridays, Saturdays, and possibly on Mondays. The decision to proceed will allow Big Ten teams to compete for spots in the college football playoff field, with the league title game expected to be scheduled 1 to 2 days prior to the December 20th announcement of the 4-team field for postseason playoffs. Fans will not have the option of attending games this season. Penn State Vice President for Intercollegiate Athletes Sandy Barber said all 14 Big Ten schools have agreed not to sell tickets to the games to the general public in 2020. She said the conference is working details which will allow parents of participating players to attend. Big Ten Commissioner Kevin Warren said the plan, as approved, is the product of a collaborative effort between administrators, medical personnel throughout the conference, and meets the objective of ensuring the health and safety of participants as they return to competition. Our goal has always been to return to competition so all student athletes can realize their dream of competing in the sports they love, Warren said. Wednesday's decision applies only to football. Warren said administrators will begin discussions Thursday about the possibility of other fall sports that were postponed, resuming competition this fall using the same medical protocols as football. Some sports, he said, may continue to move forward with plans to compete in the spring as the NCAA has moved national championships to several of the spring semesters. And that does it for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Thursday, September 17th. I'm your reader, Mary Dove. You can access a recording of today's reading on the website of iowaradioreading.org anytime. Thanks for listening.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is EarthDate. Sometimes we have too much electricity, but more often, grid operators are carefully managing its production to be sure that we have enough. So, a lot of work has gone into trying to store excess electricity to use later when we need it. The obvious solution, giant batteries, is still too expensive for most applications and has environmental implications. This has led scientists to look for other ways. One method uses surplus power to compress air and pump it into old salt mines. The salt tends to seal cracks in the walls, making the mines airtight. When needed, the compressed air can be released to turn a turbine, or it can be used as the intake air for a natural gas power plant, making the plant more productive. Another way to store excess energy is to pump water uphill into existing reservoirs and then release it through hydroelectric dams when power is needed. This method was pioneered 100 years ago in Italy and Switzerland and is used today around the world and in many U.S. states, like Michigan. On the Chilean coast, they're even experimenting with using solar energy to pump seawater up a cliff where it could flow down to make power at night. These solutions don't make economic sense unless the electricity is very cheap and the reservoir was already built for another purpose. But when those two things are present, pumping air and water to store energy plays a valuable role in balancing the grid to meet our ever-changing power demands. For EarthDate, I'm Scott Tinker.
EarthDate is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more EarthDate stories at earthdate.org.